Evacuation sites, obviously the jungle has to be cut, paths through the jungle so you can get up to the higher ground in an orderly way. The sites that have been selected, the land has to be levelled. An area suitable for the latrines has to be identified. A source of water has to be worked out in advance. Maybe it's okay for a well there. Maybe you've got to bring it in. But all that has to be worked out. Medevac plans have to be worked out. The injured have to be taken to hospital. Which hospital where? Standby arrangements for food. That was done. I did that while I was there because this province too, West Sumatra, is also, in fact, exports rice, and there are plenty of rice warehouses all over the province. You just need to have an arrangement in advance with the government's marketing agency so that you can draw rice from them to hand out freely to people in the event that it's needed. Standby arrangements for fuel so that when your trucks start rolling in, your landing craft, your helicopters, you have an arrangement with the fuel companies so that you can draw fuel. Tents, stockpile at strategic location. Crucial for that too. And supply hubs and routes worked out so that when the button is pressed or the earthquake hits and the tsunami rolls in, your trucks can start rolling in, your landing craft, your coasters, your helicopters, and it's all worked out in advance. So I'll stop speaking here. I've got a few more things to say, which I hope I can cover in the questions, but we'll now move on to the slides, and we'll show you a little bit about what I've been talking. Much of the island is lying in ruins like that. As you can see, the earthquake has demolished that building. And then the bridges. The bridges all over the island in terrible shape. This one, as you can see, there is a vehicle coming across. When I went across that river, which you can just see down to the bottom left, and I'll try and point that over there, I forded the river in the vehicle, but on the way back, that was a raging torrent. There had been rain, so I had to come across that bridge. This is the remains of Bandar Aceh Hospital, just the sign left. Interestingly, you can see there that the hills are quite close to where I'm standing. And just about here is the extent of the damage. This is looking in the other direction towards the sea, looking north. And that is all that's left of Bandar Aceh Post Office. So if you've been sending letters there, you know why they haven't been delivered. The devastation within a couple of kilometres from the coast in much of Bandar Aceh is immense. And here you can see everything has been razed almost to the ground, apart from just a couple of houses which are still standing. And those houses will have to be pulled out. As will that one over there. I mean, you just have miles and miles of Hiroshima-type scenery where the tsunami washed everything away, or almost everything away, and then the bulldozers, Indonesian army bulldozers, moved in and leveled everything flat. Here you can see just get it in focus. A boat, which has been washed up, there it is, washed up on the land. And this is right in the middle of Bandar Aceh town, and there are in fact hundreds of boats that you see washed up all over the place. Here's another couple. Now, you can see houses in the background there. Those ones are probably inhabited, so the people have got shelter, although there will undoubtedly be structural cracks in the buildings and probably major renovation is required. This here is in the middle of the town. It's actually a power barge. It's quite enormous. It's just been washed up into the middle of the town. To give you an idea of the scale, you can see my car just there where I've got the pointer, and that's a Toyota Land Cruiser. So just washed up in the middle of the town. And here's another one. This is a coal barge on the left, and the tug that goes with it was just washed up as well. In fact, you can't see it in this shot, but further over here, there's a little cafe which has sprung up where the owner is using the shade that the barge provides to shelter his customers from the sun. Now we're going a little bit south to Chelang. And I selected this slide here to show you the temporary living centres right here. These are the so-called internment camps, barrack-like structures which were put up by the government very promptly, but which the people are not happy to be living in if you had your own house, no matter how small it was. And this is what the temporary living centres look like. A long corridor outside, and you have rooms off the corridor. But some of the displaced have made them quite cosy. Over here you can see, she's got her pots and pans there. She's making the meal, she's grinding a coconut, so life is not that bad. But who wants to stay in that 12 by 12 foot room, for more than a few weeks? Now it's 8 months, and they're likely to be there for 3 or 4 years. And I'm only saying 3 or 4, because that sounds a little more hopeful than 5 or 6. Nobody knows at this point. Most of the people are living in tents, and as you can see, some of them are really not geared for the tropics. These two look in reasonable condition still, but many of them are in tatters, quite obviously, after 8 months in the rain, tropical rain, and the heat that you have in Aceh. This is Chelang, or what's left of it. You can see in the foreground everything is totally demolished, and the people are living in tents. You can see they're up on the higher ground, but all of this, which was Chelang, doesn't exist anymore. 2,000 people in Chelang. A few shots here of the relief effort. Obviously, for the really rapid stuff, we used helicopters not to move bulk food, but to move people, to move medical supplies, to evacuate the injured. We used helicopters. This is a Russian Mi-8. And here's an American Puma. And we have all of these on charter from private companies. The UN doesn't own a fleet of helicopters or trucks or ships or anything. It goes right to the market and hires what it needs, but it has standby arrangements with a number of companies, so we get them quick. Helicopters are vital too to move aid workers around, and the people you see on Bandar Aceh Airport there, in fact, aid workers waiting to go to one of the dozens of destinations where relief operations were set up. But the bulk of the supplies, of course, have to move by ship. And here you can see a couple of coasters loaded with, I think those are sardines over there, and this is bags of rice. Ironically, we were able to get rice from the USA, probably from Baton Rouge, quicker to Aceh than they were able to get it down there. But this is U.S. rice on the wharf at the second port for Bandar Aceh. The first port was washed away completely. This is about 60 kilometers away, the nearest port, but American rice being unloaded through the World Food Program, I should say. Of course, most of the ports, too, in Aceh were totally washed away. So we had to use landing craft. These are LSTs, which usually carry tanks. But we had four or five of these on charter to go to places where the only way to get your supplies onto the shore is to run up on the beach and put down the ramp. And here are supplies being loaded on to trucks to take the supplies inland to the hundreds of camps that have been set up. A few shots now picking up the pieces. The UN was able to get a large works project going. These people are just clearing up the rubble, and there are 30,000 people working on projects just like this. I mean, they're in groups of anywhere from 50 to a couple of hundred, and they're doing quite simple jobs, but they are earning money, and money is what they need. As I mentioned, the rice harvest, or rather the rice crop, was not seriously affected. And here's a shot of paddy fields which are being flooded. Rice is grown in flooded fields. That's purposely done. And since the tsunami hit, there are two crops a year there. So we've had two good crops since then. Fishermen, well, they lost over half of their fleet, but some of the boats are being rebuilt. This is a project funded by South Africa, and it's to build fishing boats. And this boat here is obviously not a new boat, so that was one of the 40% that survived. But fishing has restarted. At the beginning, people wouldn't eat fish in Aceh after the tsunami. They just wouldn't do it. I mean, they didn't like the idea that there were dead bodies floating all around in the ocean, and the fish were probably feeding on them. But that's all past now, and I do have to say that some of the best fish that I've eaten in the world is in little restaurants in Bandar Aceh. Wonderful fish, wonderful shrimps. And houses are starting to be reconstructed. This is a building, a community centre, which is going up. So this has only started in the last couple of months. We had 6 months of relief. The reconstruction is now underway. But, as the slogan says, we need more help. This is Bandar Aceh, a small village just on the outskirts of Bandar Aceh. I'm going to move on now to West Sumatra, 1,000 kilometers more or less southwest of Aceh. And this is Padang, the capital, which has a population of 900,000, 600,000 risk. And this here, which is the central bank, is one of the buildings which is, or one of the 30 buildings which are considered earthquake and tsunami safe. The university is another, but that is off to the left. You can't see that. But that's what the town looks like. Of course, over there you've got the ocean. Earthquake drill at a Padang high school. And as I mentioned, what happens is that in the classrooms, a whistle blows or a siren sounds, and the kids get under their desks. That's the first thing they have to do to protect their heads from the falling masonry should there be an earthquake. After that, there's a second signal, and they then grab their knapsacks, their backpacks, their school books, put them over their heads, and rush out to open ground. And this is what they're doing here. Then on a tsunami signal, which is a different signal, they all rush off to one of the 31 designated safe buildings, and that's how it works. And as I say, when this drill was taking place, we had a 6.3 earthquake. I went off in this little helicopter to assess the state of disaster preparedness. It took just 3 days, in fact, to do it, but I went to the farthest northernmost point of the province and to the southernmost and various areas in between, and the vice president had the report a week after he asked for it. So here's the coastline of West Sumatra. As you can see, it's quite heavily populated along the coastline, and you do have rivers and lagoons just inside from the coast, which make it really a natural for disaster in the event of a tsunami. Padang is not the only city. This is Pariman to the north, and that's a town of 73,000 people, and you've got some fishing boats there in the harbour. But obviously, but you do have high ground too. So even if this is swamped, provided people know they have to go here. In fact, there are hills around closer than that, too. Provided they are prepared and they've got a plan, most of the people can be saved. But you only have between 5 and 14 minutes, it's been calculated by the scientists, to get out of the way in the event of a tsunami. That's 5 to 14 minutes from the time the earthquake hits to the time that the wave starts rolling in. So you've got to move very quickly. You must know where you have to go. Bridges, very vulnerable. You know, obviously the old wave rolls in here and you have houses, habitations, all along this coastal road here. In France, you've got coconut and palm oil plantations, and then over here, you've got rice, and that's the pattern all the way along the coast of West Sumatra. Here you can see very nice coconut plantations. It's in fact West Sumatra, although it's highly vulnerable to the tsunami, it's one of West Sumatra's richest provinces. All agriculture. But as with Aceh, fishing is a major industry, and there we've got the ocean off to the right, and lagoon here. Obviously, it doesn't take much imagination to see what will happen to that if you can't get those boats out of the way. And that's one of the things, I only covered the main points in the recommendations, but it was to designate safe harbours for fishing boats too. With this shot here, you can see how close people live to the ocean. On the beach there, you can see fishing boats on the beach. And again, it doesn't take much imagination to see what will happen if an enormous wave comes rolling in here. I mentioned that land had not been, evacuation sites, although identified, had not been, the land had not been leveled or the sites really prepared in any way. And this is at Air Bungis, which I'm really so worried about. This is in the northern extremity of the province. It's a little fishing town of 18,000 people. And up here is the designated site. But I'm standing on the outskirts of the fishing town here. And the people, if the tsunami comes, have to get up here. Well, first of all, you know, there's no land leveled for to put up tents or temporary shelters or anything. And how do you get up? You know, you're going to hack your way through the, that's what you got to do, hack your way through the forest and step on people on the way up, hack off a few legs as you're doing it. Absolutely hopeless. So obviously the recommendation there was to clear paths through the jungle, to level the land, designate a place for the latrines away from the water, and the living area, and to prepare the site. Now, when I asked the mayor of the town, and here he is, I asked him, why haven't you done that? You know, it's not going to take much to sort of do that. And he said, well, we have no funds. And I didn't accept that as an answer because, you know, half a dozen men working for 3 or 4 days, they could chop paths through, and there's a lot more that can be done. Now, I don't know whether that has in fact been done. I hope it has, because you can see that he is a very worried man. How is he going to cope with his 18,000 people in the event of a tsunami? And here are the people. And, you know, I really think about these people quite often and hope that he has at least cleared those paths. Because these are the people, I'm sorry to say, that won't be there in the event that the scientists are right. I mean, we all hope they're wrong, but there are things that can be done to minimize the impact if the tsunami strikes.
So I would ask if we have anybody to ask the first question, if you'd like to come forward, please, to this microphone.
Hi, Trevor. Thank you for bringing us somewhat up to date, you know, over the last 8 months, because we certainly all saw what was happening, heard and read about it, but to get some kind of a progress report. My question relates to, if you can give us a thumbnail sketch of where you see the UN, the World Food Program, future involvement from now on.
Thank you, Henning. I mentioned that there have been contributions of about $7 billion to Aceh, or to Indonesia, for Aceh and Nias. Of that, about half, just over $4 billion, has actually been delivered. How long will it, and I did mention that the reconstruction has now started, I would love to be able to say in earnest, but I think that would be a bit of an exaggeration. So far, if I can find my figure here, I'm looking for the number of houses that have been constructed. It's actually dismal. There have been something like 169 houses only that have been constructed. 814 are in the process of construction. And 4,800 have been contracted for, you know. But you've got 500,000 people displaced. Now, not all of them are heads of household, but there have to be at least 20,000 houses required. If you ask me how long this is all going to take, I would say a good 10 years. Roads. Now the Americans are building the a main highway. It'll improve things considerably. I mean, it's the old one that's been washed away in many parts is going to get a spanking new highway. The Germans are putting in the General Hospital in Bandar Aceh. Health centers are, well, I put together plans for 500 health centers for financing by the Asian Development Bank. And I'm not sure whether I mentioned the community development project, which I was able to put together with the World Bank, part of the restructuring of the relief effort into rehabilitation, reconstruction. And that involved irrigation ditches, drainage canals, houses, mosques, schools. And, you know, it's going, but it ain't in full swing. Now, the major rehabilitation, reconstruction work has to be done by the private sector. You know, we, meaning the UN and the non-governmental organizations, we're the relief guys and mini-reconstruction. But ports, harbors, highways, bridges and that kind of thing, that's the private sector. So the fact that we have a peace agreement now, the peace agreement's holding, the troops are being withdrawn, the rebels are handing in their guns is all very positive. If that holds, things will speed up. Right now, it's just starting the reconstruction. 10 years, Henning. Not before, in my view.
I'm wondering what kind of material is being used when you showed us the picture of the slide of the house being built. It looked like there were wooden posts for the main frame, and then there were green sort of joists, and I wondered if those were plastic or pipe or something, and then there was brick on the ground. So I wondered, where is the wood coming from? What kind of material does it actually come from, Indonesia, or is it being imported, and who would pay for it?
Yeah, thank you for that question, and that's been a concern, that the relief operation, the 400 NGOs there and the UN and everybody else, doesn't cut down the rest of Indonesia's surviving rainforest in order to rebuild houses. The temporary structures are in fact wooden frames with plywood sheets for the walls and CI sheet, corrugated iron sheet roofs. The wood, some of the wood is coming from Aceh. Other wood is coming from elsewhere in Indonesia, but not from rainforest, from areas that have been designated as commercial forests. So it's not a willy-nilly sort of operation there. And it's quite slow because of those safeguards that have been put in to make sure the rainforest ain't denuded any faster than it's happening now. But of course, the downside of that is you often have to wait for your wood to arrive.
I could just ask you to identify yourself, please.
My name is Bob Anderson. Trevor, that was an important message that we needed to hear, and it raises all sorts of issues. After the number of earthquakes that you've been through, if in the course of my question I refer to you as Tremor Page instead of Trevor Page, you'll understand my slip. I wanted to back you up a little bit into the UN and your part there. It seems to me that the fact that the UN could pluck you out of Lethbridge and put you down there within 4 days speaks to a certain amount of efficiency. I'm wondering what kind of comment you would make on the kind of role the UN played. You began getting into that a bit. It was a more immediate role. But a lot of aid was not channeled through the UN. It was hither and thither, and probably some of it got there. But do you feel that that kind of efficient functioning of the UN will continue to grow and be enhanced, or will developments of this past week, where it's now up to about 400 amendments, have pretty much scuttled a whole lot of the future hopes of the UN, is that going to have a debilitating effect upon the kinds of things you see the UN doing and that you were involved in?